ओम ज्ञानति निरंधस्य ज्ञानंजन शलाकाय चक्षुर्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। So continuing from yesterday, this discussion of preaching Krishna consciousness in India. Actually, yesterday I went through, I wasn't looking at my notes, there are a few points I missed out which I'll now speak, they'll come somewhat out of sequence, but so that everything's complete, I'll put them in, then I'll go on to pick up from where we left off yesterday. Now, one thing I was saying is this seminar is mostly for devotees who are preaching in India, especially those who are making some commitment to spend time in India. But actually, we see that many devotees, they come regularly to India, or even if you just come for 1 month every 5 years, you're surrounded by people. That's one thing you notice. It's a heavily populated country and a huge country. So many people, and people are interested in us. I don't think I notice so much anymore, but I know devotees, when they first come to India, they notice how people are looking at them. Especially if you go to places where our movement is not so much well known. If you go to towns where our devotees don't go much, or our movement's not well known, you may notice that people are looking at you all the time. And certainly when we travel on trains and buses, planes, for those of you who travel by plane in India, definitely people will start talking to you. Indian people are very gregarious like that. Especially in the villages, people have no qualms about just walking up to you and talking to you. So there's unlimited opportunities for preaching. Preaching is always there, and our devotees are meant for preaching. The whole life of this movement is preaching. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement is preaching. So the basic mood of a preacher is there wherever you are, whether you're in India or China or England or America or wherever, the basic mood is there that we want to communicate the message of Bhagavad Gita, the message of Krishna to people. We want them to take up Krishna consciousness, maybe at different levels, appreciating, taking it up personally in their lives, becoming convinced of the philosophy. The basic mood of the preacher is there, feeling of compassion. We want to help people, or at least we want to preach, at the very least, out of a sense of duty to pass on what we have received from our spiritual master to others on his order. But again, the point that even if we're coming for a short time, it's good. Actually, I want to make this into a, transcribe this and organize it and make it into a little booklet, so that even devotees who are coming, even maybe they're only coming to India for 2 weeks or a month, it'll give them a little insight in how to communicate Krishna consciousness to people better, because definitely opportunities are going to be there. One important point which I overlooked, I think I overlooked it yesterday, is that there's a tremendous feeling, devotees who are preaching in India, that if you feel the pulse of the country, wherever you go, you find so much interest. And of course, it's mixed with a lot of confusion and all the defects of the conditioned soul, lethargy, even though people may be interested, they may be lazy to take it up, or attached in so many different ways. But there's definitely a feeling that something is big is here. That there's a tremendous feeling that this country can very easily, the whole country can become Krishna conscious. The feeling is there. Of course, it's in every country of the world. Every living being is innately a pure devotee of Krishna. But next class, 6 o'clock. But the feeling is here that this movement, it's progressing geometrically. It's like Varaha Avatar started very small, but even when small was interesting and unusual, gradually grew bigger and bigger until it literally picked up the earth. The Supreme Lord in the form of Varaha Dev. So in the same way, this movement in India, when I say this movement, of course, Hare Krishna movement is in this land since time immemorial. But this particular manifestation, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, started off what to many people seemed as maybe something insignificant or a novelty, but the effect of it is growing and growing and growing. And the nature of geometric growth is that, you know, everyone knows that story that someone was asked to put two coins on the chessboard, put one coin on one board, two coins on the next, four on the next, eight on the next. No, how does it go? Two, two, and then four, then four, then four on the next, then 16 on the next, then 16 times 16, 140 the next, and like this. So it becomes. So that feeling is there that Krishna consciousness can spread and actually have a tremendous effect within a short time. It's a matter of organization, hard work, praying to Krishna, and the feeling is there that something very positive, very, very wonderful can happen. Now, I was talking about the atmosphere in India as compared to the Western countries, the cultural atmosphere, the spiritual and cultural atmosphere. Now, there's one important example which Srila Prabhupada gave many times, comparing Indian culture to Western culture. He said that in India, even a simple farmer who's not educated, he knows that he's not the body. He's received this body due to his past karma. He has whatever he has to suffer and enjoy according to his past karma. When he dies, he goes to another body. And he knows when he sees a sadhu, he should bow down, offer his respects. Whereas even in the Western countries, and Prabhupada many times gave the example of Professor Kotovsky in Moscow, that even a very prominent, learned person is such a fool that he says, Swamiji, when the body is finished, everything is finished. So that is difference. Prabhupada gave a lecture, East and West. He was asked to give a lecture in Calcutta to some American Cultural Association or something like this. So he said, actually there's no difference. Everyone's in Maya everywhere. But if there is any difference, is this difference that at least in India people know that they're not the body, whereas in the Western countries, even so-called learned people, they haven't got even the beginning of spiritual knowledge. The very beginning of spiritual knowledge, they're totally ignorant about. So that is an example that Prabhupada gave many times. Another thing I was talking about was tolerating. You may get sick and this and that. Another thing which devotees from the West often feel scared of, or they find very difficult to tolerate, is the heat of the summer. Those, of course, there are hot places in the Western world also, just like Florida maybe gets very hot, and different places get very hot. But the Indian summer is it's rather intense. It's hot. It's in most parts of India during towards the end of April through May and up till mid-June, if the rains break in mid-June. Otherwise, sometimes all through June in different parts. Every day throughout most of India, the temperature will be up above 40, and at night it doesn't cool down too much. And in some parts, I was in Vrindavan one summer, every day was going above 50, which is hot. And at night it wasn't getting cooler. And people die from the heat and so on. So it's quite intense. But my way of looking at it is that there are millions of people living in this country. They live through the heat. What for? For the purpose of eating, sleeping, mating and defending. So can we not also live with them for the sake of preaching Krishna consciousness? So in this way, we just talk about it. That Krishna says in Gita, Matra spashas tu kamtya, shita ushna. He gives it cold and heat. These things are there. They come and they go. So it's again, it's a matter of adjusting the mind. That if you adjust, all right. And the Prabhupada, he wrote a letter to Achyutananda, who was alone in Vrindavan in the summer, which is, it's hot in Vrindavan in the summer. When I say hot, it means hotter than most parts of India. So he said, what's the problem? You just, in the afternoon when it's hot, you just close all the doors and windows because that stops the hot air coming in. You turn on the fan if the electricity is on, and you take a little rest, and just like everybody else does, and then you get up in the evening, afternoon, about 5 o'clock, and you go and you do your work. You go out. That's what. When it gets very hot in the summer on our bus parties, what we used to do, because in the summer the life goes on till 11 o'clock. The shops stay open, so we start book distribution at 5 o'clock, go to 11 o'clock, then we take rest, and we get up a little late because we take rest late. Or in the villages, we do a program. We start after everyone, maybe 7 o'clock. We go up to 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. Pack up and take rest late. Get up and then during the day we maybe sit in the river or for some time, 1 or 2 hours. Sit in the pond and chant our rounds, read a bit, sleep a bit, eat a bit, and then in the evening we do our work. Life goes on. And after some time, the summer ends and the rainy season comes and you go on. If you just adjust your mind, it ain't going to stay. It doesn't matter. So many people are tolerating the heat, I'll also tolerate. And after some time you get used to it. Get used to it means just like in the Western countries, cold in the winter and people complain, but they live through it. They don't think, well, now I'm going to cut my throat because it's too cold. They live through it. So in the same way, you get used to it. And all right, now it's April, and now it's going to be hot for the next 2 months, and chalega, as they say, that things, life goes on. So it's a matter of adjusting the mind, that's all. Actually, there's one very interesting story. I remember one devotee told me many years ago. It's similar to this. He was in Germany or Denmark or somewhere in the winter, and it was raining and cold outside. So he thought, well, today I won't go outside for book distribution. It's too nasty, the weather. So then he heard some noise outside. He looked outside, and some men were digging the road, repairing the road. So he thought, they're outside in this horrible weather to earn some money for sense gratification. So can't I go outside? If they're going outside for sense gratification, I can go outside to serve Krishna. So it's the same thing. All right. One example, I was talking about the decline of the culture. One example you can give also, that just like any city, especially in South India, say 20 years ago, if you went, you would see, you'd hardly ever see anyone in, any men wearing pants, trousers as they're calling, or pants as they call in Indian English. Nowadays it's very difficult to find anyone wearing a dhoti. Those days everyone wore a dhoti, South Indian style, wrapped around without the catch at the back. And so it's ridiculous, it's absolutely ridiculous because it's so hot in South India. And these pants, they make it out of this polyester. I can't imagine, but it must be so hot and uncomfortable. As dhoti is just nice, it's very cool and nice. But because some crazy idea that dhoti is old fashioned, so people, they don't wear it. So that's just another example. How the culture has gone down. Yeah, and another example now this is very interesting. I mean, we meet so many people, we talk to so many people, but one thing stood out in my mind, one in particular incident, because that kind of captured for me the something about the Indian mentality as it's going on today. That once I was on a train going to Orissa, and I spoke with one, speaking with one professor, an Oriya man, who was teaching in Kalyani University in Bengal. He was a scientist. So I started speaking to him about Krishna consciousness, what we usually do when we meet people. So then I was speaking along the lines that Prabhupada gives in the book Life Comes from Life, that there's no proof of evolution, it's all bogus, it's all cheating, and going through all the examples he gave. And then he was giving some other arguments, he was giving some objections, but basically he was interested in what I was saying. Then after discussing for some time, he thanked me and said that actually I was brought up as a devotee of Krishna, but in school I was taught this science and all these, and of course I'm a science teacher and I believe in science, but I also believe in Krishna, so I couldn't understand how to put the two things together. But now that you have explained, I can understand that actually the science, as it's being taught, is all bogus, and that our scriptures, this is the actual correct knowledge. So I discussed this. I had a discussion once with Sadaputta Prabhu from Bhaktivedanta Institute, and he had some interesting observation that you'll find many people in India. See, what it, his observation is just like in India, there's unlimited demigods. There's 330 million demigods, among which about maybe 20 or 30 are prominent, and then there's Krishna also. And there's local demigods, especially, you know, in different areas of India, especially in Rajasthan, every village area they have their own little demigod that they worship. And even in Rajasthan, there's one temple, they worship rats. That's there. Rats also the carrier of Ganesh. I don't know exactly what the reason is. Anyway, there's so many different things, and they've invented so many gods, and they've made new gods. Some people worship Mahatma Gandhi. That's kind of become unpopular. it invented Bharat Mata. I mean anything. It's just, you know, stick a potato on the side and start worshipping it and some people will come and join you probably. You know, it's like, I mean, Sada Bhuta Prabhu, he made the observation that among the vast pantheon of Hindu gods, there has become one new god which stands above all others, called science, which people respect with tremendous reverence. It's just like previously people in India, they had such faith that if you quote Shastra, it's very complete, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, oh, then they have to accept. Nowadays, if you say Sri Scientist Uvacha, oh, scientist said, oh, then we have to accept. It's the same dogmatic, blind faith. But they think that now we've become very intense. They criticize religion as being blind faith, but actually they tend to have a blind faith in science. And it's very difficult for Indian people because of this great sense of awe and reverence they have for science, that if you say that science is cheating, it's very difficult for them to accept. Whereas in the Western countries, it's, at the present time, it's, if we say this, people, many people, they take that very easily. Of course, India, they think they're very modern, but they're always a long way behind the West in their way of thinking and everything. So, but anyway, Siddhartha, he made some observation that it's like Indian people, they have two compartments in their brain. One side is science and one side is religion, and they keep them separate. They may be a scientist or a science student or a science teacher, or they may just believe in science, whatever that means. And they also believe in religion. But they keep them two things separate in their brain. They don't try to mix it up. Otherwise, they don't try to get a synthetic worldview. Of course, there are some people who, there are some attempts, and often scientifically minded people, maybe like yourself, are enthusiastic to make a synthesis of science and religion, but often in a kind of strange way. They want to prove that everything in the Vedas backs up modern science, whereas the actual Bhakti Vedanta, the actual understanding has to come from Shastra. That is the proper way of understanding. And if modern science happens to concur with that, all well and good for modern science. And if it doesn't, then we can't accept it. That is the proper way to see it. But they tend to see it around the other way. That we have to show that the Vedas, that also fits with modern science. Because in other words, they take science as being the most important thing, and the Vedas as just something to back it up. So anyway, this is an important point to understand when we'll come to that later, speaking in colleges among intellectuals, that this idea of science and progress, this is another mythological word which has entered the Indian psyche, the word progress. They're very great devotees of progress. That this maybe some of us are a little older, we remember when we were children, we used to hear about these fairy tales about how progress, how by scientific progress the world will become wonderful and everything will be very nice and all the problems will be solved. So now, of course, in the Western countries, you can't say these things. No one believes it. No one believes it anymore. Maybe there are a few crazy scientists who still believe it, but people in general, they don't believe such things. But in India, people still think, oh, science. By science, we will solve all the problems. Some things to be understood, how people are thinking. That's why this Life Comes to Life, and especially that Origins magazine, when we distribute that in the colleges, it's like dropping an atom bomb in people's heads, or maybe a neutron bomb. The atom bomb destroys everything. The neutron bomb destroys all the paraphernalia, but it keeps the infrastructure intact. So in the same way, that Origins magazine, it's like a revolution in people's consciousness. When they read, oh, is that? Oh, really? and so on. We'll come back to that later, but about preaching to educated people, but that's an important thing to understand, that people, they have a natural piety, a natural tendency to believe in Shastra, in Krishna, but they don't really understand why. The world view of educated people in the modern age is very much shaped by science, that they want to understand things in a scientific way. So even though there's a tendency to worship God, they don't really understand why they should, which is one reason they're very impressed by our devotees when we can speak to them in a philosophical way. They very much like that, that we can explain to them in a philosophical way. Many times people say that, yes, of course, I know this is our culture, but I never understood why we did these things. And many times, just like misconceptions they have, just like worshipping different demigods and so many misconceptions. Hinduism means it's every misconception you could possibly imagine, plus more, because there's all the misconceptions that other people have imagined. It's all the imagination put together. And when intelligent people start to speculate, then you get some pretty good concoctions, or pretty bad concoctions, whichever way you want to look at it. So it's all kinds of fabulous, very horrible way people have interpreted. Sometimes the way they speak about Krishna, just recently we met, so was it that, yes, I mean, some things are so horrible, I don't even want to repeat, but just to give an idea of how some of these rascal swamis, how they make their interpretations, that when Krishna was shot in the foot, so that was to finally relieve him from his sins, because in his Ram avatar, he shot Bali, and so he had some karma, so he had to come back again, and then he did some sins in this life. But that finally cleared him of all his sins, and then he got liberation. So, I mean, these kind of people, you want to cut their throats, so they can't speak anymore. But we have to do that by preaching. So you see, people are confused. But when we can explain, systematically, logically, with Shastra, point by point, then people who are somewhat submissive and who are interested to know, they're very much impressed by this. So going back to the point by point, I was saying that people are appreciating, especially in India, many high-class people are appreciating this movement. Now that's one thing, you'll find Prabhupada, he often speaks about high-class, low-class, and that is very much a factor in Indian life. High-class people, low-class people, it's there everywhere in the world, but it's especially prominent in traditional societies, the people who are, even the way they talk, the language they use, their behavior, their culture, actually the caste system meant that practically, if you, in different, there's Tamil people, Bengali people, Oriya people, there's different, but even within, if you see the Tamil people, for instance, you'll find that the Tamil Brahmins, they're a completely different species to the Tamil Shudras or less than Shudras, because they never intermarried, and their facial, their bodily features, the color of their skin is completely different, the language they use and their consciousness also is very much different. It's still a fact that those, generally speaking, those who are born in higher caste families are higher class and generally tend to be more pious. Although, of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement is for everybody, but the high-class people, even today, those who are born in Brahmin families tend to be more intelligent, tend to be. So, anyway, our movement is especially being appreciated by many high-class people. This is something which in recent years has come, that previously we were attracting mostly village type people, very simple people, but now more and more we're attracting many educated people, high class people, Brahmins, even people who for generations their fathers, forefathers have been initiated maybe in Sri Sampradaya or Madhva Sampradaya, but they're now coming to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. And even a very interesting thing is that many Brahmins from smarter backgrounds, smarter means they're not Vaishnavas, they're traditional Karma Kandiya, materialistic. They tend to worship Shiva as supreme, Maya, very much Mayavad influenced. But even we're finding many Brahmins from such a background are coming to this Krishna conscious movement. It's very, this is a very, I don't know, I mean, there's so many things to say. It's maybe not coming out systematically, but it's coming out anyway. Now, it's very interesting that you see that for many, many years, for generations, in these different bona fide Vaishnava sampradayas, especially Madhva and Sri sampradayas are very prominent in as much as they have many people who, for many generations, they were following. Vallabh sampradaya is also quite prominent, but Nimbarka sampradaya in Vrindavan mostly. But the Brahmins especially who used to follow, they'd understand that many of them, the young boys, they would be sent to study the philosophy, they'd study the Sri Bhasha or the Purnapragya Bhasha of their sampradaya. They would be trained in puja, the Brahmins would do puja every morning. Their lifestyle was such that it was practical for them to do that. They, mostly the Brahmins, they were pujaris in temples or they had land. And even up to recently, many, many people, they used to do puja in their home for many hours and they very strictly followed the principles of their caste and followed the principles of Krishna consciousness according to their sampradaya. Now modern life with urbanization has changed all that. That one thing is the... You'll find so many temples in South India, the pujaris, they can't make a, they can't support themselves by just doing the puja. When the temples were taken over by the government and they granted the pujaris maybe 7 rupees a month salary. So 7 rupees a month in 1950 or whenever they took it over might have been sufficient. But nowadays, of course, it's ridiculous. You can't do anything with 7 rupees. So, the temples, The Brahmins, they can't live as Brahmins. That idea, the kings, they used to support the Brahmins, the wealthy men, that's not there anymore. That the whole cultural infrastructure has broken down. So now the Brahmins, what are they doing? Many of them, they're doing their own businesses, or they're doing office jobs, or government jobs. And the situation... Anyway, these are all social issues. In Tamil Nadu, the situation has become so bad that even it came in one magazine that one man from Brahmin family, he's taken up the job of carrying dead bodies, which even lower than Shudra will do that, because how will he live? He can't get any job. So, anyway, the point I'm making is that the traditional way of life that Brahmins used to follow, which was very nice actually, based on Varnashram rules, they would rise early, take a bath, worship their deity, they would use well water only for the deities. And they would have their own special wells which no one else could use, and they were very strict. No one could go in the kitchen unless they were, took a bath, and they had all the different samskars, and they followed the Vedic culture was being followed quite strictly until recently. But now it's not possible to do that. Just like if you live in the city, you have tap water, and the tap water is recycled sewage water usually. So, and you know, what are you going to do? You have to use that for your puja. And every house has attached bathroom. Now if there's attached bathroom in any building, it means the whole building is impure. You, according to traditional rites, you can't use it for puja. And even people, they don't have time. They have to be at the office by 9 o'clock, and they have to get in the local train with 5,000 other people, maybe literally on the local train. And they're all touched up to people who are eating meat, and it's a horrible situation. They literally cannot follow the old culture, but they have a feeling for it. Because in their childhood, they were brought up, they saw that culture, at least the remnants of it. And when they grow older, they feel, they want this, and they want to communicate it to their children. But they can't, it's not possible to follow. Therefore, they're coming to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement, many of them. I'll just tell a little story to illustrate this. That one man in Karnataka, one state in South India, where the Madhva Sampradaya is very prominent even today. Udupi is the place, in Karnataka is the place of the Madhva Sampradaya. So, He's actually from a Kshatriya family. So Kshatriya families in India are generally meat eaters. But he had read some different spiritual literatures, and, or spiritual law, whatever it may be. And he was thinking, I don't like this meat eating, and I'd like to lead a spiritual way of life in my home. So he came to the Udupi Swami. There are different sannyasis in Udupi who are heads of the Madhva Sampradaya, and they're very nice devotees. They worship Krishna in a very traditional way. They're very first class in everything, their worship, and they have traditional followers in Brahmin families. So this man, he asked the Swami that, what should I do? I want to be a worshipper of Krishna and give up meat eating and bad habits and lead a pure life worshipping Krishna. And Swami said, well, actually I don't know what to do, because I don't know what to tell you, because we can only teach according to our caste lines. So I think you should go and consult the people from ISKCON. They'll tell you what to do. He himself said that we don't have any guidance, but we can only guide within certain lines. But the ISKCON people, they will tell you what to do. So we're going to find out more and more. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he predicted that all the four sampradayas, they will merge into Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's sampradaya. And we can see one reason why that will happen, because in Kali Yuga, the only practical method for spiritual advancement is chanting the holy names. The elaborate pujas and the elaborate caste rules which were previously followed, it's not possible to follow. The modern way of life is such that it's just not possible to follow. And even people, they don't have so much inclination for that. But everyone can chant Hare Krishna. So we're going to find this more and more and more. And another thing we're finding, talking about other different sampradayas, is that we find that generally the leaders of these sampradayas, they're very much appreciative, actually, of ISKCON. The Brahmins in general and Vaishnavs, those from traditional Vaishnav backgrounds, they're very appreciative that this Hare Krishna movement is upholding the Vedic culture. This came in Illustrated Weekly of India, which was previously the most prominent, respected magazine in India. Now it's been eclipsed by this most rascal in India Today magazine, which is, it's like a takeoff of Time, and it's just how everyone in India should go to hell. That is the unspoken purport. Everyone should become like an American. In this magazine, and I'm going off on a tangent. I'll go down that alley later. So anyway, in Illustrated Weekly, this came many years ago, and this was just like at a time of watershed for our movement, because after that time there'd been a lot of skepticism, and this was maybe in the early 80s or late 70s. It came, the front cover picture of our devotees worshipping, Western devotees worshipping Krishna in Vrindavan. This is the cover, and it's the cover page story, and the title was Saviors of Hinduism. That actually the Krishna conscious movement is upholding the Vedic culture, upholding this culture which was otherwise going to be lost. So the leaders of different Vaishnav sampradayas, they tend to be very much, they like this movement. They like it very much, that it's spreading Krishna consciousness. And they understand that we can do things that they cannot. In Udupi, there's some of the Swamis, they're saying that, for philosophy, for deep study of Vedanta Sutra, we have all these things. But for propagation, if we want to know how to spread Krishna consciousness, then the ISKCON people, they can do that. They have some shakti, they have some blessings from Krishna to do things, which, of course, Madhvacharya, he knew how to do it. Ramanujacharya, he knew how to do it. But they've become a little stagnant, in as much as the people who were converted many years ago, their descendants, it's a big groups of people. So they're still working within that group, but they can't expand outside their group. They can't do that. That's another point. Apart from the methodology, how to worship Krishna in the old sampradayas, not being practical for modern life, another thing is that the method of teaching philosophy, it's mostly In Madhva Sampradaya, for instance, mostly in Sanskrit language. Who wants to understand Madhva philosophy, they have to study Sanskrit. In Sri Sampradaya also, it's in Tamil also, that's a very old, high style. But the point is that the way they teach philosophy, it's based on the books of Madhvacharya, Ramanujacharya, and other acharyas in their line, Vedanta Deshikar and Jayatirtha and all the, in which it's very, the manner of presentation is very complex, and it's at a level which is not even very suitable for the modern age. It's like the old, you can understand from this how much depth of philosophy was previously in India, that they, how they taught philosophy, going into great depth and just some hair-splitting point that some Mayavadi may make, and then Vedanta Deshika will write, you know, a book about some minor. And that's another thing, if you understand, you can see how Prabhupada, in his preaching, how pages and pages of philosophy, he'll capture it in a simple example. So this point, that Prabhupada, that whole philosophy, he captured it, and he was able to present it in a way just suitable for modern man. If we're, nowadays, if even if you learn, even if you want to study all Madhvacharya's teachings, Ramanuja's teachings, but to relate to the common man, it's only a few scholars who can even begin to understand what they're talking about. But for preaching to the common man, using examples from Shastra in simple language, this was a great gift that Krishna blessed Prabhupada with, and he has communicated it to us. How to communicate Krishna consciousness, the same philosophy, in a way which modern man can appreciate. So also that's another tremendous feature of our movement, which other Vaishnava movements, they don't have that. They can tell stories from Mahabharata and Srimad Bhagavatam. They can tell stories, but when it comes to philosophy, they only have some slogans, just like the Mayavadis will say, everything is all one. And the followers of Madhvacharya, they will say two. But to present it in such a manner that people can understand, it's not just you're in this camp or that camp. So it's not a sectarian point, but this is actually the philosophy of the Absolute Truth. This is why it's two and not one. And this is why it's two and one also. That everything is all one in one sense, inasmuch as everything is one in quality. We are in quality, the same as God, but in quantity there is a great difference. And Prabhupada, of course, gave the example of the drop and the ocean. But we cannot stress exclusive oneness without accepting that God is great and we have to worship Him. So Prabhupada put it in simple language, and the fact that we can put it in simple language and communicate it to people, that is a tremendous strength of this movement, which people very much appreciate. People appreciate that we can present philosophy. So I was saying that yesterday also, that the fact that we can present it, many people they very much appreciate that. They can become convinced by that. Now, apart from the logical presentation, there's also the shastric presentation. Actually, in my preaching in India, if people come and they say, well, I believe in this, if they have some kind of wrong religious idea. If it's not Krishna conscious, it means it's wrong. I believe that Lord Shiva is supreme, or I'm a follower of... Actually, many times the people we're preaching to, they're not particularly followers of anything. It's the same all over the world. If someone's already a follower of Christianity, for instance, then generally we don't preach to them. But if someone may say, well, I heard this about Christianity, then we can preach to them. If they're open, if they're already committed in one camp, it's very difficult to preach to anybody. But if someone is open, many people are open, but they're influenced by different ideas. So they may think that someone, but I heard, just like one time, I was giving a lecture somewhere, then afterwards one young girl came up to me and said, why did you say that that all the gods are not the same, that Krishna is supreme? I said, well, of course we have to say that because that's the actual fact. That's what it said in Shastra. But she said, but all the other Swamis, they say all the gods are the same. In other words, they hear all the other Swamis, all the other garbage, and their mind is confused. So then we say, all right, so many people may say this, but what does Shastra say? What does Krishna say? But Swami so-and-so, he's a big Swami. All right, he said that. But what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Do you know Bhagavad Gita? Krishna says this. Krishna says, Mataparataram nanyat kinchid asti. Nothing or no one is greater than or equal to me. There are a few key verses which we should learn. Actually, one sannyasi of ISKCON was preaching in South India, which is the land of wrong philosophy, Mayavad, demigod worship, everything. In all of India is everything bogus, but especially in South India they like to talk about it more. So he sent a letter to Prabhupada with the purport of which was help. What am I supposed to do? Because all these people, especially in South India, it may happen anywhere, but especially in South India, someone may just walk up to you and say, Swamiji, I was reading this verse from the Taittiriya Upanishad, and he'll quote something to you. What do you understand by this verse? So he may, people, they may, or you may be giving a lecture and you quote some verse and they say, but Shankaracharya, he, regarding this verse, he says this. So you may come up against so many things. So he said, well, how will I preach? He wrote to Prabhupada, said, what should I say? What should I do? So Prabhupada wrote back and said, there's no problem at all. You just learn 50 verses from Bhagavad Gita. You ask anybody, do you believe in Bhagavad Gita? They'll say yes. And so what is the problem? Someone says, I believe in demigod worship. Alright. So then next thing you ask them, do you believe in Bhagavad Gita? They will say yes, is Prabhupada writing his letter. So then you quote, Antavattu palam tesham tad bhavati alpamedhasam. Anyone who worships the demigods is a fool. Alpamedhasam. Okay, that's demigod worship finished. Then next point. So, like this, if you just learn a few verses, you see how Prabhupada preached. He would make the point and then stick to it. They say, no, but this Swami, this Swami says, but Krishna says this. Now, who is more important? So-and-so Swami or Krishna? Krishna says this. But so-and-so interprets like this. He may interpret. Okay, what are the words? Antavat. What does this word mean? Do you know? You go through it word by word. This means, antavat means it has an end. It means temporary. Antavat. Tu, vat, phalam, fruit, tesham, of them, tad, they, sorry, that, bhavati, become, alpa, small, medasa. And most Indian people they can follow, because in their language all these words are there. Medasa means intelligence, alpa means small. So it very clearly says, there's no other meaning, that those who worship demigods, because the result is temporary, therefore they are foolish. This is what Krishna says. Do you believe it or not? And you just stick to that. That's all. So this, if we stick to Shastra, is very powerful for preaching. Of course there are those who don't believe in Shastra. But even then, if we're quoting Shastra, say this is the authority, even then, even if their faith in Shastra is not very strong, the fact that our faith in it is strong impresses them also. And that's another whole line. Then again we're coming to, I'm sorry, I'm not very systematic today, it's kind of going here and there. But another line of scientific, those who believe in science, I don't believe in Shastra, this is all mumbo jumbo, mythology. This is another thing, the British, they used these very nice words to blaspheme, that, Swamiji, have you read in the Hindu mythology? Mythology, of course, means that which is just stories, not true. And the first thing you'd say, that's not the right word, because they're saying it respectfully. They think mythology, they mean the Shastra, but they say mythology. So then you have to explain to them. Myth, that's from the Greek word, which comes from the Sanskrit, mithya, which means false. So it's not mythology, it's Shastra. So this is the actual fact. First thing you have to tell them. Don't use this word mythology. So even those that don't have faith in it, or superficially don't have faith in it, or whose faith in it is very weak, they tend to believe in science. Then we have to preach them in a scientific manner, means in a logical, step-by-step manner, establishing belief in God. That you believe in science, so science, what is the function of science? Science makes different machines. So machine means there's order, there's purpose. So if we see in the universe there's so much order, of course this is all devotees should know this kind of preaching lines, wherever they're preaching in the world. So I won't go into it in detail. But if there's order, we have to conclude that there's a maker, a designer, there's some purpose. No one makes a machine without any purpose, so there must be some purpose. So what is the purpose? That we have to find out. How will we find out? Then there are so many different arguments. Just like if an ant is crawling here, what can he understand of this room, what we are doing here? Because he's an ant. His ability to understand, even though he sees, he hears, he smells, he touches, and he tastes, he can't understand what we are doing in this room, why there is a room, or even if there is a room at all. Because by his sensory perception, because his intelligence is limited, although he perceives, his ability to interpret and understand what he perceives is so limited that for the ant, his whole universe, his universe and his university, his history, science, biology, chemistry, geography, literature, everything is how to go from my hole to that grain of sugar, bring it and come back. And that's his whole learning. So in the same way,